Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It's a bonus edition of the Sports Jersey Dispatch podcast here. Today we have Sam Zigner, a great Sabre historian, that's going to talk about some South Florida baseball before the Marlins played in the MLB with some great players that came through there. We have Sam coming up in just a moment. Hey, this is Darren Hayes. You've probably heard me on the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch. Well, welcome to my journey of learning more about sports history. And we're going to do it by learning about the great athletes and the uniforms that they wore, as they both tell a lot about the games that we love and have watched so much throughout most of our lives. These are the chronicles I'm going to share with you on what I've learned through my journey in the Sports Jersey Dispatch. Hello, my friends in sports history. This is Darren Hayes of the Sports Jersey Dispatch. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your place for all things great in sports history. And we have a great program for you tonight, a very special bonus edition of the Jersey Dispatch podcast, where we have a gentleman named Sam Zigner, who is an author and a historian of baseball, a big Sabre member down in Florida. Sam Zigner, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thank you, Darren. A pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight.
Yeah, we are excited to have you here talking a little bit about some South Florida baseball history. We're up north. We don't get a lot of that history, and I can't wait to hear about it. But I guess before we talk about that, I'd like to learn a little bit more about you. What made your interest so much in baseball that you're writing books about it?
Well, I grew up around the game. My dad was a coach. I coached like an American Legion type of baseball when I was a kid. I remember many a night with my great-grandfather listening to Cincinnati Reds games on the radio. And later, I just continued that. Read a lot of books when I was a kid, attended a lot of baseball games, and not only the ones my dad coached, Pittsburgh Pirates games, Cincinnati Reds games, mainly on the radio. And as I got older, I just stuck with it. I always loved baseball, went to games, kept going, minor league, major league, didn't matter. I've even attended down here some of the University of Miami baseball games, which are very interesting. They have a great team. And I came to Florida in 2001. And one of the things that I discovered, and when I came to Florida, in Miami specifically, was not a lot of people knew about the history of baseball in the area. It's kind of like, for most people, and if you understand Florida, it's kind of a transient area. Baseball kind of began in 1993 when the Florida Marlins launched. But what people weren't aware of, baseball in the area goes back clear to 1892.
Really?
Started with town ball, graduated to the outlaw leagues, which were outlaw minor league leagues. They weren't officially associated with the National Association. That grew into certified minor leagues, where they were started in like class D ball, worked up to where it was eventually you got into the Florida East Coast League, Florida International League, up till 1956 with the birth of the Miami Marlins, which was the first Marlins, which was a AAA affiliate in the International League. And that team was started by an icon, Bill Veeck, and Satchel Paige pitched in Miami for three seasons back then. Eventually, the AAA team folded in 1960. And when I wrote this most recent book, Baseball Under the Palms, Volume 2, basically what happened is it was a reboot in Miami for minor league baseball. After not having baseball in 1961, in 1962, it launched again with the Florida State League as a Class D league, which went to Class A the next year. And for the next 30 seasons, we had Class A ball for the Florida State League. One season we had AAA again, the Miami Amigos, which was a short-lived team in the Inter-American League. And they had some independent leagues teams, and that went up to 1991. The last team in Miami was actually the Miami Miracle.
Wow, that is some rich history there. It's quite a variety of names. Was there any like significance behind any of those names, like the Miracles? That sounds like it must have some deeper meaning, maybe, that you're aware of.
Well, you know, if you go back to the history, the original team and like the 19 teams, you had the Miami Seminoles, which was an outlaw league. It was a minor league, but not officially sanctioned by the National Association. You had the Magicians came along in the 20s, same thing. And then in 1927, the first sanctioned team came along. There was teams, I'm just going to give you an example of some of the names over the years. We had the Wahoos. You had the Tourists, the Sun Sox. One time we had two teams in Miami. We had Miami Beach and Miami. So you had the Sun Sox and the Miami Beach Flamingos. Then you go, eventually it goes back to the Marlins again. Marlins again. Then the, when the Baltimore Orioles came down here in 1966 from the Phillies. You had the Marlins for a while, but they changed the name to the Orioles. And then eventually when the Orioles left town, it went back to the Marlins. And then the miracle was the last three seasons that Miami had a minor league team in the Florida State League.
Now, did they all these teams, minor league teams, all play at the same venue, or was there multiple venues involved?
Well, going way back, it was the Royal Palm Grounds in Miami. That was a part of a resort hotel. When it got to the more modern era, they played at Miami Field for a while. What the most recognizable stadium in Florida, or South Florida anyways, was Miami Stadium, which was a state-of-the-art stadium built in 1949. And that stadium was used right up until they played in there till 1989 was the last season they played there. And then the team temporarily moved to Hialeah, Florida. And then after that, they moved to Pompano Beach, Florida, but they kept the name when they were the Miracle. They still kept the Miami notation on the hats and so forth to have the name recognition. Of course, with the Marlins coming, the Florida Marlins were coming and territorial rights. That was basically the death knell of minor league baseball in the Miami area.
Well, that's very understandable. You don't really want to have a minor league team where you have a major league team. That wouldn't make much sense, would it? When you're striving that far long to get a big team. Is there some good backstory to how the current Marlins got into the major league baseball? I mean, how it went from a minor league up to a major league?
Well, for a long time, people in Miami were looking for a higher grade of baseball, and that was one of the complaints that they had about the Florida State League and the A-level team, that they felt Miami deserved a higher level of baseball. Not to say that it was a low level of baseball. The talent was very good. For instance, over the years, players like Fergie Jenkins started in Miami. You had Eddie Murray. These are Hall of Famers. Cal Ripken Jr. was in Miami with the Miami Orioles, as was Murray. Fergie was a member of the Marlins in 62 in the initial season and was there in 1963 also. Going way back, Maury Wills came through Miami and his minor league career before him going to the major leagues. And so you had a lot of players, a lot of names. I mean, Johnny Oates, Don Baylor. These are just some of the names that came through the town that fans got to see before they made the jump to the major leagues. But basically, when the Florida Marlins started, that was driven by a gentleman by the name of Wayne Huizenga, who owned at the time, one of his businesses was Blockbuster Video. I don't know if probably some of our older listeners will remember Blockbuster Video. And he was the main driving force to bring Major League Baseball to Miami. And that started in 1993. They came at the same time, I believe, that the Colorado Rockies started. And within 4 years, the Marlins actually won a World Series, which was almost unheard of at the time for an expansion team.
Now, I believe Mr. Huizenga, didn't he also own the Dolphins at one time, too?
I believe he might have, because I know that at one time that he had a name recognition with the stadium out there. I'm not sure. I'm not as well-versed in football as probably you are, but.
Yeah, I think he might have. And I think he, besides Blockbuster, he might have had something to do with waste management. I believe, maybe I'm thinking of the wrong person, but I think I know it's so owner down there. I think it might be him.
Exactly right. He did. He
okay.
Management company. Yeah.
Yeah. You're stirring some memories from the fog is clearing a little bit. So I appreciate that. Oh yeah. That's pretty interesting. Cal Ripken Jr., you said, was playing minor league baseball with the Orioles affiliate down in Miami. Now, was he sort of the Iron Man that he was in the major league baseball too?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He did. He was in the lineup pretty much every day when he was in Miami. He was there during the 79 season. His history to Miami and Miami Stadium goes back to 1967. His dad was the manager of the 67 Miami Marlins. And Cal Jr. and his brother Billy, who both played in the big leagues, they used to run around Miami Field and shag fly balls. They kind of acted as semi-ball boys, hung out. They basically lived at the stadium. Cal Sr. and his wife Violet were very into baseball, as you can imagine. And so it was almost like the ballpark was their second home. And then Cal, when his baseball career launched, he started out in Bluefield, West Virginia, but was promoted to Miami. And in 1979, he was with the Miami Orioles. And basically, he's in the lineup every day. Interesting thing, though, about Ripken, he was not a home run hitter then. He didn't hit his home run till well, first home run that season, to well into the season. Though Miami Stadium was a ballpark that was hard to hit a ball out of. But still, he didn't hit his, I think his first home run came about a month and a half or 2 months into the season.
But now, I was going to ask that question. Now, down in Miami, I guess any era, with the humidity, I assume you always have down there, is it a lot harder to hit home runs down there as compared to some of the more minor? I'm not counting like Colorado, but some like Arizona. Is it easier to hit a home run like in Arizona ballpark than it would be in the humidity of Miami?
Yeah, the higher altitude really is an advantage to the batter. In the minor leagues and the Florida State League in general, a home run leader in the league would usually lead the league with 12 to 15 home runs in a season. The humidity played a huge part in that. Miami Stadium was a very difficult, it was really a pitcher's park, it was very difficult to hit a home run out of. It was 400 feet to center field, and then there was a high wall behind the center field wall. And then down the lines, it was, I think, 330, 340 each down each left field and right field poles. And so, you know, that doesn't sound that deep, but when you mix it with the humidity and the wind always coming in from the outfield, if a guy hit 10 home runs or 12 home runs for Miami, that was considered a big season. One guy 1 year, Jim Fuller, who had a brief turn in the major leagues, he actually one season hit 33 home runs in the Florida State League, which was colossal.
Jeez, that does sound like a formidable field. Plus, you got a couple things going against you. Now, I guess would the pitching, would that make a difference too? Because maybe a little bit of moisture on the ball, you know, you're not throwing an illegal spitball, but a little bit of moisture on the ball. We know that can make the ball do some crazy things.
Yeah, I think definitely that played a role. The humidity in the ball. Teams tended in the Florida State League also, I found in doing research, tended to send their better pitching prospects to the Florida State League and tended to send their better hitters more towards the West Coast, like out to Stockton, Bakersfield, those type of cities. I guess it was more of a confidence issue, you know, when you're starting at the lower level, maybe. I'm just speculating, but you go to the Florida State League and it really does build your confidence. As an example, Ferguson Jenkins' first year with Miami, he came about halfway through the season. He had a 7-2 record, but a 0.97 ERA.
Wow. That's really good. I assume that would probably do reverse confidence the other way too. So if you're a good hitter, you're going out west. If you end up going down south and we're against a tough pitching, your batting average is going to drop, where the good guys are going out there and really padding their numbers against lesser pitching.
Yeah, if you hit 300 in the Florida State League during those years from the 60s, 70s, 80s, even in the 90s, you were considered a pretty good hitting prospect. As an example, Eddie Murray, when he was a 19-year-old in Miami in 1974, he hit 297, and that was considered really good. There was one other guy on the team who hit a little over 300 named Jeff Faramisco. Interesting story there. Talk about two players going in different directions. Eddie Murray and Jeff came a little later in the season. He was through the June draft. And when he arrived, he played the last about 53 games, I believe it was. But he had similar numbers to Eddie. And as you know, Eddie went on to a Hall of Fame career. So when Jeff returned the next season for spring training, Eddie had moved up, but Jeff had some difficulty in spring training. He was having trouble with his breathing. He was having trouble. He had headaches, really severe headaches and so forth. And they kind of had the two guys on the same course. You know, oh, these are huge prospects. They're going to move up. Jeff's career in 75 was derailed from, you're not going to believe this. He became allergic to grass and dirt.
Oh, my goodness.
So this kind of tells you, you know, in the minor league is fickle, how guys go to the top. Some guys peel off to the side. And basically, he had to retire from baseball at an early age. He was on track to go right up the system to the Orioles.
Oh, boy, that's a shame. You can't even really, like, trade him to the Astros or something because there's still dirt there, huh? And you still got to play away games. Wow, no, that really stinks.
The doctors and everything in Miami, they had him every kind of therapy you could imagine. And he eventually said, you know, I can't play. They basically said, you've got this allergy. You have to play on grass every day. And he had to turn around, and he actually became a teacher. And the interesting thing is years later, he overcame the difficulty and was able to overcome through a lot of therapy and work with doctors. He overcame his allergy and was able to go back to a field and play. But he was quite a bit older by then. His baseball career, you know, had moved on.
Great ending to the story, but gosh, that really stinks when you're an up and comer like that. And then he's probably following what Eddie Murray's career is doing and seeing him just, you know, put up monster numbers and having a Hall of Fame career. He probably saying to himself, that could have been me.
Yeah. And you think Jeff was on the same track and then all of a sudden,
yeah.
Oh. Bad luck, I guess.
Yeah, that's
sometimes
for sure.
That happened.
Now I see you got a couple, books there beside you. Are those a couple of your books that you've written?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Darren. Actually, I've written three books. And this one, the first book I wrote was The Forgotten Marlins. This was the history of the original Miami Marlins from 1956 to 60. As I mentioned earlier, Bill Veeck launched this team and Satchel Paige pitched out of Miami for three seasons, which was quite a story in itself. A lot of experiences he had while he was here. It kind of inspired me to finish and do the rest of the history of Miami. I wrote with my co-authors, was actually my wife, Barbara, and I wrote Baseball Under the Palms, which was a history of the early years, 1892 to 1960. And then we followed that with Volume 2, which was baseball when it rebooted in 1962 to 1991. So we covered all of those years. It was quite a intensively researched book. Both of us worked very hard on it, but it was really fun getting to work. My wife is a huge baseball fan, so we share a love of the game. And she grew up in the game. Her father played in the minor leagues and also in the Cuban Winter Leagues, but he also played in Miami at one time for the Miami Beach Flamingos. It was part of his playing career as a catcher.
Very cool.
So these are the two most recent books, Baseball in the Palms, of course, Volume 2, the most recent. And then this is what it kind of all started, was The Forgotten Marlins.
Now, are they still available for sale? And if they are, if you could tell the listeners where they might be able to purchase these.
Sure. As far as the two Baseball in the Palms, they're available at Amazon.com. You can find it also at SunburyPress.com. That's my publisher. The Forgotten Marlins is also available on Amazon.com. or through Scarecrow Press, or you can go purchase that through Roman and Littlefield is the main publisher for that book.
Okay. And we'll try to put some of those links on the show notes of this podcast, so listeners, so if you're driving, you can get connected to Sam and in his books so that you can get copies of those. So we'll put those links out there with the titles to try to help that out.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. So you said your wife has that background of baseball with her father, you know, being a player and everything. Is that how, did you and your wife meet through baseball?
Actually, and funny, we did not.
Oh, okay.
It's an interesting story that goes back a long ways. But I came to Miami. We got married in 2001. And actually, I didn't know about her father's career until we started dating. So it was really interesting. I guess baseball, like minds, tend to attract to each other, you know?
Right. Hey, and, but in the real world, that really usually doesn't work out that way, Sam, though. I know, like, my wife is, isn't real a big fan of any sport. And she just supports me because I watch the sports, but she'll usually go in a different room and go watch one of her programs. But it's interesting. Huh.
Yeah, I'm blessed that way. I don't think there's many guys that have that blessing, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, you are very, very rare. So kudos to her and to you for that and helping you write those books. That had to be quite a feat to do, to share that with your wife and see it go to print and get those first copies in your hands. That's got to be quite a thrill.
Yeah, we love working together, and it was, it sounds cliche, but it was really a labor of love for both of us. It was just so fun, and we even got to speak about her dad in both of the books, of course, because he played in Florida, and later he had an organization called Los Cubanitos that when the first Cuban kids came over here in the early 60s, he started a baseball league for them to keep the kids off the street and teach them, the right thing to do. A lot of these, some of the kids that he coached went to the big leagues. One of the most famous graduate was Freddie Gonzalez, who used to be manager of the Marlins. He also managed the Atlanta Braves. He's a bench coach for the Orioles now, was one of the names. And then quite a few of the kids grew up and went on to play in the minor leagues too.
Wow. So she can sit there and say that her father helped maybe cultivate the interest in baseball that propelled these guys to go on to bigger and better things. That's really neat.
She grew up around the game for sure.
So you said he was a catcher. Now, is that a position that your wife still follows because her father was a catcher or knows most about, or is she pretty well versed in all the positions?
She's pretty well versed in all the positions. I think catcher is her favorite position, obviously, because of her dad. And she knows the game pretty well. I mean, we have a conversation. It's just like talking. Well, she's not one of the guys, but it's like, we have in-depth conversations about baseball players. She's very knowledgeable. And so it works well. We work together. I mean, it's great.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. Now, you were saying earlier, though, you're from some different cities around the country. Now are you a strictly a Marlins fan, or do you go to some of your roots at some of your other towns? Or, you said you used to watch the Reds and listen to the Reds and Pirates on the radio when you were a kid. Are one of those your teams, or do you have some other affiliation you like to follow?
Well, I'm a diehard Pirates fan. I see you have Forbes Field in the background.
Yeah.
When I
share your pain.
Tough, isn't it?
Yes.
I followed the Reds when I was younger also, but the Pirates were always the team for me. Later, at one point, my family moved to Utah. My dad transferred with the company he was with, and then I followed a team called the Salt Lake Angels, which were a AAA team in Salt Lake City back in the Pacific Coast League. At some point, I lived in Arizona. I followed the Diamondbacks. Living down here, I kind of semi-follow the Florida State League. We have the Jupiter Hammerheads and the Palm Beach Cardinals down here. And then, of course, they train here for spring training also. But all these years, of course, I follow the Marlins, Florida Marlins. It's tough. I follow the Marlins, and I'm a Pirates fan. you have to really hang in there and have a thick skin.
Yes. Hey, you got a rough sporting world, that's for sure. Yeah, it's tough being a Pirates fan, isn't it? I know. I mean, I'm in my 50s, so I grew up, Roberto Clemente's, went in the 71 series, and, I remember the 79 series very vividly as a kid. I was very much into it, and, the early 90s were pretty good, but, gosh, the rest of it wasn't a whole lot of things to cheer about being a Pirates fan.
Oh, yeah, it was rough. 79 was such a great season. I remember Willie Stargell and Chicken on the Hill with Will. He had a chicken place over there, And of course, they had so many players that one season. It was just magic. You had Scrap Iron, Phil Garner, Omar Moreno, Ed Ott, the catcher. Bill Madlock came in a trade during the season. Burt Blylevin was there for one season. I mean, it just came together that year. We are family,
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, that we are family. That was such a perfect motto for that team. And especially when you have your leader being Pop Stargell, you know, having the name Pops, and you know, Dave Parkers and, you know, the Garners. And, you know, like you said, that was just some great teams. And really, you could, the community could really connect around those guys because they've just played so well. And it was, you know, it was the city of champions back then. The Steelers were playing really well. The Pirates were really, really good. And it was just a fun time to grow up and be a kid. And then, the Pirates, you know, just sort of falling off the face of the earth there for about a decade. It was really hard.
Yeah, until the Andrew McCutchen era for a while, we had some few good seasons, but we just couldn't get over the hump, unfortunately.
That's true. That's true. And even had some good pitching then, too. And just had to, they don't have the money to spend that some of the other clubs do. That's, I think that's the main gist of it.
Yeah, it seems like we're in a constant rebuild, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Well, hey, I really appreciate you coming on here talking about this South Florida baseball history. You really educated myself. I'm sure the listeners will be the same and will say the same. And really appreciate it. And we'll get copies of your books. And once again, why don't you give us the titles of your books? And we'll, like I said, we'll put them on the show notes of this. And also, if you'd like to give any of your social media handles so people can follow you, you're feel more than welcome to do that too, please.
Oh, thank you. The first book is The Forgotten Marlins. That's a tribute to the 1956 to 1960 original Marlins. They were a member of the International League Triple A League from 56 to 60. Then we wrote Baseball Under the Palms, History of Minor League Baseball in Miami, 1892 to 1960, and then Baseball Under the Palms Volume 2 covers the years 1962 to 1991 before the Florida Marlins launched, and that was the end of minor league baseball in Miami. But so many great players came through here, it was just amazing.
Well, Sam, we really appreciate you coming on here. Your triumvirate of books there, you got it, you know, everything triangulated in the minor league baseball system with some great players, some great teams from those eras. And thank you for sharing that with us today in the Big Ben.
Oh, no, thank you for having me on, Darren. I really appreciate it. It's great meeting you and your audience.
Sorry, but my pitching coach just called timeout and he's coming out to the mound. I think I'm going to get yanked for a reliever. We'll see you back tomorrow for some more great sports history on Sports Jersey Dispatch Podcast. We invite you to check out our websites, jerseydispatch.com and pigskindispatch.com, not only see the daily sports history, but to experience the preservation of great events and people that play the games. Find us on Pigskin Dispatch. It's also on social media outlets of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel. Get all your daily sports history. Pigskin Dispatch is happy to be associated with the Sports History Network, the sports headquarters of yesteryear, found at sportshistorynetwork.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.